What Amy and I have done is we have co-authored new diagnostic guidelines for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And these are NIH expert consensus guidelines. So we can talk about how that happened and the structure of it and why we have new guidelines and how they're different.
Well, so let's start and just focus on the guidelines before we get to the how. So how have the guidelines changed? What are the new guidelines and how has it changed?
Okay. Well, the reason we've done the guidelines has to do with the fact that we have 10 more years of experience with evaluating children who've been exposed to alcohol prenatally. Much of the research that's been done over the last 10 years helps to further define the neurobehavioral phenotype associated with kids who've been exposed to alcohol. And I'll let Amy address that because that's really her bailiwick. But the new guidelines are more specific. They have a new definition for what constitutes significant maternal drinking in pregnancy. One of the issues we've always had is how much alcohol should we say you need to have? And in some ways, we've used some of the definitions that have developed over the last 10 years, so that's different. We're much more specific about how much drinking you need to have to be able to apply the guidelines. The other things that have changed has to do with a new definition of partial fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the kids who have some of the physical features but not all of them. That's been redefined. And then the biggest thing is that in each one of the categories, we're much more specific about the neurobehavior that's changed and altered in the kids who've been exposed.
Okay, so many questions now are just coming to the surface. So do you want to jump in here, or do you want me to keep asking?
One of the things I think is really nice with this new diagnostic criteria is it increases in the precision to help clinicians really on the front end be able to better identify and then intervene on these cases. And Dr. Hoyme mentioned the increased attention and presence of the neurobehavioral aspects of it, which is basically the behavior and the cognitive effects of prenatal alcohol exposure, have been much more defined and exact in there. We were always really good, dysmorphologists and geneticists were really good at identifying the face and physical characteristics that went along with prenatal alcohol exposure, but really it's been only until the last couple of years that we've gotten a lot better at identifying the behavioral and cognitive effects.
And the behavioral, but that comes later when the child's older.
It gets easier to recognize, no doubt about it. We are working on trying to identify it earlier and earlier, but especially for when you're looking at testing cognitive or intellectual functioning, ability to understand more abstract thought, or executive functioning is a word you'll hear frequently with this. That's kind of the ability to plan ahead, to think what are the consequences and to plan ahead. That's an area we really see kids with prenatal exposure struggling with. That doesn't come developmentally until age 6 and 7 really is where we're best able to identify it. But again, we're moving that up earlier and earlier to see what the precursors are.
And the facial, let's just kind of back, I mean, in the past, 10 years ago, it was, you know, facial features and head measurements and growth,
And, you know, the facial measurements and the growth of the head really are reflective of the development of the brain. So historically, with fetal alcohol syndrome, what we were able to recognize was significant early gestational damage. So women who drank fairly heavily, or at least binged heavily in early pregnancy, that would affect the brain and the developing embryo at an early stage, and then that secondarily would affect the face. So the face was altered because of that early insult to the developing brain. But of course, that is the tip of the iceberg and is dependent on pretty specific early gestational damage. What the real continuum is children who've been exposed to varying amounts of alcohol over the entire span of the pregnancy. And after your face is formed, it doesn't change. So what you end up seeing is that there are probably many, many more children who lack the typical facial features but still have significant damage to the brain from the alcohol exposure. And so what these new criteria allow us to do is to really diagnose the whole continuum of disability, so you'll probably see more accurate definition of what the true prevalence of this disorder is, because historically we had to depend on the facial features and the growth of the head, which were important and still by far are the hardest data that you can see when you're evaluating these children. But these new criteria, because of the specificity of the behavior and cognitive development, I think allow us to really expand beyond the kids who have the typical dysmorphology.
And so how, when the child is 6 years old, or when you can actually start doing these cognitive testing, how can you track how much the mother drank actually during the pregnancy?
That's a good question. It's amazing to me when we sit and we talk with parents. And sometimes they're biological parents. Sometimes it may be a family member or a foster or adoptive parent. But the common goal really is to try to help figure out the best way to help the child. When they come into the clinical office and are looking for solutions, they're looking for help in this. And people tend to, if approached in the right way, in a sensitive, non-judgmental way, tend to be very forthcoming about behaviors that may have impacted the development of the child. A lot of people know that prenatal alcohol can affect the baby. What a lot of people don't understand is that also applies to them as an individual, and that it's their behavior also can affect it. Sometimes we attribute things like prenatal alcohol to other groups. That only happens in this group of individuals. And what we've seen increasingly from our research is prenatal alcohol exposure happens across all racial groups, across all socioeconomic statuses, and it really is a problem related to alcohol, not a geographic necessarily bound issue.
Or racial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens in all populations around the world where people drink during pregnancy. And as Amy said, I think one of the things that research has shown over the last decade is that this, although this can happen in the offspring of chronic alcoholic women who have the social and physical stigmata of drinking for decades, the most common drinking pattern that leads to disability in these babies is weekend binge drinking before they find out they're pregnant. So we're talking about women who go out with their friends on Friday and Saturday evening and may drink five drinks in an evening over a period of hours. And then they go to work and they work in their office or they work in a on the farm or whatever, and they don't drink during the week, but then again the next weekend they drink. There are some, and again that cuts across racial, socioeconomic, geographical boundaries. So here in the Midwest we see it in children of attorneys and physicians and nurses and people who are lower socioeconomic backgrounds.
That early in the pregnancy, before they even know they're pregnant.
That's when most of the damage is done. Most of these women, once they find out they're pregnant, either stop or they cut back significantly. But the damage, if you binged, let's say you don't find out you're pregnant until 16 weeks, that and you binged every week, that's 16 binges, and that's a significant short-term blood alcohol elevation. And that, both in experimental animals and in humans, is the typical drinking pattern. What we worry about in our population in the upper Midwest is binge drinking, and binge drinking among both men and women. And it's a big problem. It's it happens in college-age students, happens in young professionals, and a lot of women, what we found, at least in the prevalence studies we did here in South Dakota, was that women who had affected children found out about their pregnancies later. So not only did they drink more than the women whose children were unaffected, but they got prenatal care later. Now, I have yet to meet a mother who wanted to hurt her baby. And so these women don't intend to do this. This is not a willful thing. This is, as Amy said, thinking, this isn't going to apply to me. And they may not be careful about birth control. I mean, our message is to women is, if you're planning on becoming pregnant, then you shouldn't drink. And you shouldn't drink at all, because we don't know really, although we've defined what alcohol exposure is significant associated with prevalence studies. I can't tell you a lower limit of what you can drink in pregnancy. So most women will say, you know, for those 40 weeks of my life, I'm okay not drinking. You know, it's not it's a social thing for me. And when I'm not pregnant, then I'll probably go back to drinking moderately. But, you know, I think the other issue is that if you are going to continue to drink and you don't want to be pregnant, then use good, reliable birth control methods. So the message is plan pregnancy and drink smartly based on what you decide to do with your own life and your reproductive planning.
Yeah, and just to show how that applies on an individual level as well, Dr. Hoimy mentioned the importance of binge drinking. And a binge drink for women is defined as 3 drinks on any one occasion. This is not an excessive amount of drinking. In fact, it's a relatively normal drinking pattern. And in fact, my husband and I went out for dinner last night, had a glass of wine, and they filled it up to the top of the glass. Actually, that would count as 2 drinks by a standard definition. Jumbo margaritas, that's a little more than just 1 drink, for example. And so a lot of times when people think, again, oh, binge drinking, oh, I don't go out and party and drink a whole case of beer, that's not what we're talking about. We're actually talking about a pretty normal pattern of drinking for women and for men in this country.
And so this is early, before you may know, right, for 16 weeks. But what happens drinking later, and what is the allowable? Is there an allowable amount, or
well,
that does damage? I mean, I mean, you say 3 for women,
right? So, going back to the criteria, we define significant alcohol exposure, both in terms of numbers of drinks, and Amy is younger and has better memory than I do about exactly what those numbers were, and she can tell you that. We also use the social definition. Okay. So if you have had a DUI, that means that you've had significant alcohol exposure. If you have had, there are these screening tests for excessive drinking that physicians use. One is called TACE, for example, and you wake up in the morning and need to drink an eye opener. Do other people comment on your drinking? That's there are these social definitions of what excessive alcohol exposure is. Sometimes we do biomarkers on mothers and babies. So you can actually test the first stool, the meconium that the babies have, and you can look for fatty acid ethyl esters. I have a hard time saying that fast. That really show how much drinking has happened in the last part of pregnancy. You can look at hair and fingernails and things like that as well. So that if you have that kind of biomarker data, you have evidence in the medical record or social records of problems with the law or whatever related to drinking, those are significant amounts of drinking. But we define the number of drinks you have to have in a specific way in these criteria.
We do, and that is really more of a guideline for clinicians to help to identify what some significant exposure would be. But I think the larger question of it is, at what level does alcohol start to have damage? And that's, you know, a public health message to get out. And I wish we could say, okay, if you drink under this amount per week, your baby's probably going to be okay. However, we know it's more complicated than that, because we do know from some of our research, like in nutrition, for example, we know that in areas in South Africa, for example, where there's less nutrition, moms are smaller, they have smaller BMI, body mass index, the alcohol seems to have a greater effect, even the same amount of alcohol compared to maybe a woman here drinking the same amount of alcohol. So nutrition matters. We also know there's genetic components that affect how a woman metabolizes alcohol, and likely placenta factors on how much blood alcohol actually gets to the baby on those things. All of that makes it a very complicated picture of how much alcohol is going to affect, which it just kind of reiterates the message of zero drinking during pregnancy. We did in our paper give guidelines for clinicians to help kind of put some parameters around it to identify what significant drinking is. But there's also these other components to it as well that you can look at to help define drinking during pregnancy, especially if the mom isn't available anymore to help answer questions.
We get two kinds of questions, believe it or not. One of the questions is, I didn't realize I was pregnant, and I've went out on New Year's Eve, and I had two glasses of champagne and three glasses of wine. Now it's 4 weeks later, and I realize I'm pregnant, and what have I done? I would say that based on what Amy said, in any individual case, it would be hard to say that single binge necessarily was going to cause a problem. So I would say that the message, if you didn't realize you were pregnant and you did have an evening like that, is to have a healthy pregnancy now. Stop. Don't continue to drink. There are lots of data that show stopping any time in pregnancy is good for the baby. So that's the first kind of question. Oh, my God, what have I done? I had a binge. The other question we have is, believe it or not, women will call and say, I need to drink. I need to go out, and it's part of my social life. I will feel isolated from my friends and ostracized if I don't drink. So how much can I drink in pregnancy? And I've had those kinds of questions, and the answer is, you shouldn't be drinking while you're pregnant. And, if your friends are forcing you to drink while you're pregnant, then I'd probably reevaluate those friendships, because that's not good for you or your baby. So we're not here to judge women. I mean, we're here to support women. And, I know that drinking is a problem in our society. It's probably the most dangerous thing for babies that you can do. In the grand scheme of people are so worried about Zika virus, and we should be worried about Zika virus, but in this part of the country, the risk for Zika virus and a baby is tiny. The risk of your going out and binging on weekends is significant. So of the two, I would be much more worried about binging in pregnancy in South Dakota than I would about Zika virus. I'm not downplaying Zika virus. That's a huge problem and something that hopefully a vaccine will be effective in the next few years and will be available. And we should exercise judgment when you do travel because of Zika virus. But in terms of babies' brain development in our society, drinking alcohol in pregnancy is much more damaging. Here in Sioux Falls, somewhere between 2-5% of children are adversely affected because their mothers drink. In South Africa, it can be up to 20% for the complete continuum of FASD. And although Zika virus is devastating, it doesn't reach nearly the proportions of kids who are adversely affected because of alcohol.
2-7% in South Dakota. So let's jump to your study. You evaluated 10,000. Is that right?
So if we look at the studies that the NIH has funded. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to we as an as investigators are able to do the work we do because the United States has the National Institutes of Health. And I think we often forget that in the United States, that the United States is really the only country in the world that has had historically such a huge investment of public dollars toward research. And the United States is light years ahead of any other country in the world in research because of public dollars invested through the NIH. So when you look at where your tax dollars are going, that's good investment of tax dollars. So the NIH has funded a whole variety of studies, mostly in the United States, but around the world as well, looking at a number of questions regarding to fetal risk and alcohol. Part of that is prevalence studies. So I've been part of a team, and Amy has been part of a group of investigators that have looked in the United States at how common this is, and in South Africa and in Italy. I've been involved with studies in Scandinavia as well. So if you look back over the last decade at the entire database that one of the investigators, Dr. May, who is now at the University of North Carolina, he has 10,000 children in the database that have been able to take advantage of looking at those data as we formulated these criteria. Now, Amy has a separate group of children that have been enrolled here in South Dakota and her counterpart in South Africa, and those are several thousand additional children.
12,000.
So there's these new criteria are based on significant large numbers of children. And these are studies that have been funded by the NIH that we've been involved with.
And your study, it's interviewing these kids. It's in a clinical setting, right?
Yeah. So each of the studies, some of the prevalent studies have taken place in the school system directly. For example, when we worked here in Sioux Falls with our prevalent study, every first grade classroom in Sioux Falls, public, private schools, all participated in that, and that would involve meeting with the kids, some then interviews with parents, some testing that went done, again, to look at some of those behavioral cognitive features, as well as then an examination of all the physical characteristics. Some of the other studies involved in it have occurred more of in a clinic setting as well, but by being able to pool all of these large numbers together, you start getting economy of scale to be able to really answer some of the big questions of what's driving the field forward. And this latest diagnostic criteria paper, the authors on it really represent expertise across the United States in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and through Dr. Hoime's leadership, brought them all together to agree on a common definition, which is no small task when you're talking about 20 alpha powerful, knowledgeable individuals, but to all come to consensus to really help move the field forward. We think that this paper was a significant step in not only bringing the scientific field closer together, but in helping to better communicate with clinicians and serve families.
So these were studies that have been funded around the United States. The most recent prevalence studies were done in several communities. Sioux Falls was the first to be complete, and we're proud of that, and had huge, wonderful cooperation of the families and the school systems in South Dakota. But the other communities are in Montana, North Carolina, and San Diego in Southern California. And so the same methodology was used, and so part of this was bringing together investigators from the University of California, from Stanford, from San Diego State, from Harvard, from the University of North Carolina, from Wake Forest, and the long list, in addition to experts at the National Institutes of Health. And over a period of a year, we met both virtually and in person at the NIH in Bethesda, and we split out tasks. So some of us looked at the physical features, the dysmorphology. Other people looked at growth. Other people looked at how you defined alcohol exposure in pregnancy. And then the most important and the toughest part, which Amy was part of, was defining this neurobehavioral phenotype. So this is a multidisciplinary team. Some of us are physicians and what we call dysmorphologists. We're clinical geneticists. We're used to diagnosing physical characteristics in kids with disabilities. There were psychologists. Amy's a clinical psychologist who from Emory and the University of New Mexico and who else was there? So it was mostly Emory and San Diego State.
Right.
And the University of New Mexico and Amy's group here at Stanford, who really developed these neurobehavioral criteria. And then we all came together and we hammered out our final paper. So the NIH is good at doing this. They've done this with a lot of things. So these are really what I would call NIH expert consensus criteria, meaning there was input from 20 different investigators around the United States. So these are not the Stanford health criteria, although Amy and I think, provided significant leadership. Mm-hmm. We're probably good at herding cats. That's why we did this, you know.
There may have been locking people in a room until we all agreed.
Well, we're from South Dakota. Well, and, you know, we're nice folks.
You're nice about it.
And so we're not. It's always good to have a South Dakotan leading these kinds of groups.
And to have psychologists on the team.
And have psychologists as part of the group is good,
So here's the loaded question, then. So you got this group of 20 to agree and to publish a paper. So now how do you take this out to the rest of the world?
I think that's where it really starts to get fun. because a lot of times for those of us that are more academically oriented, the end game cannot just be publishing a paper the nice thing is the journal Pediatrics is where it was published. So that is the flagship journal for the American Academy of Pediatrics, which means this went in the hands of every pediatrician that's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the vast majority.
Pretty much every pediatrician in the United States and Canada.
But now I think what we need to do is doing more talks, more giving out information, seeing how it works in application, getting feedback on that, continuing to present it in kind of high-profile venues that would really reach a high number of clinicians. Through this paper, we also provided some new diagnostic tools to help clinicians with identifying the lip and some of the facial dysmorphology in particular. And so there's always more work that can be done to help continue to refine it. But I think this is where the fun really begins, is when you start to see it get put out in application.
And then you have the diagnosis, and then what? And then what comes next? Because you need to bring teachers into the fold.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And that's what's so important. All of us in this field would love to be out of a job. So far, we've gotten much better at diagnosing the breadth and depth of the problem. So this disorder was described in 1973. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I don't think we've made a dent in the prevalence. We've been better able to define what the prevalence is, and that actually has been frightening as how common this is. But that's really the next difficult hurdle to really tackle is, how then do we begin to get this word out and really get people to be thoughtful about this? And we're, you know, I've occasionally had people say, well, you're laying this heavy burden on women, and we're not. We're there to support the women and their children. There's a lot of data to show that early diagnosis and early intervention leads to an improved outcome. And so what we would like to do is, to change women's drinking behavior when they are, to be more thoughtful about pregnancy, and then change their drinking behavior around that period of time. But then to be able to look at the children who have been exposed and to intervene early in terms of multidisciplinary therapy that can help them in the long run. Part of it is self-awareness. Part of it is teaching techniques. There's a whole variety of things that are helpful. Reading interventions are helpful. in this disorder. And so there are other countries, for example, Finland, which has such incredible public schools in general, but they do much better in when diagnosing and then throughout the those early years supporting those families, and their outcomes in adults are much better than ours in the United States. And the Finns are heavy drinkers. The government is very concerned about alcoholism. When they joined the European Union, taxes went way down on alcohol so that it became very cheap for Finns to buy alcohol. In the past, the government in Finland had very high taxes on alcohol, which we know from cigarette smoking in the United States. If you have high taxes, it discourages smoking. You have high taxes on alcohol, it'll discourage drinking. But the European Union had much lower taxes, so their prevalence of fetal alcohol syndrome went up after they joined the EU. And so they're concerned about that. They're very open about it. They don't hide their heads in the sand. But they support these families, and they support diagnosis and whatever. So this is a multi-pronged approach. One is prevention, which is the most important thing, and then early diagnosis and intervention for the kids, I think, is what's really important.
Because the damage on the brain it's smooth, right? Is that a simple way of saying what the brain looks like if it's...
Well, that would
exposed.
Be a severe case.
That's a severe case.
That most of the kids, if you do brain imaging, MRIs, and mm-hmm. so on, it's normal. They don't mm-hmm. have any recognizable change by traditional imaging. Now, you can do more sophisticated imaging that does show changes in subtle ways in the brain in terms of too much brain tissue in one area and not enough in another. There's an investigator, Dr. Riley at San Diego State, who is one of our co-authors on our paper, who's been a pioneer in looking at that. But, you know, if you were to take a kid who came to see me here at Sanford Health and we just sent them for a routine MRI, we would get a normal report back from the neuroradiologist. So I think that there are subtle brain changes, but not significant. But I think in the long run, these interventions, and that is something we would like to be able to pilot in South Dakota. We had talked with Dr. Holman when she was superintendent here about using, you know, now that we have identified children in Sioux Falls who have diagnosis within this spectrum, are there things that we can introduce into our classrooms in South Dakota that are really going to help these children? Part of the issue is that the medical part of this is fairly well researched now. The interventional educational part is much less well researched. And the NIH would like to help with that, and we would like to be part of that. So as part of our plans.
So that's coming.
That is coming, and Amy and I have big plans. We're not always able to carry out our big plans, but that is part of the plan.
Yeah, I think an important thing, too, with thinking about the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure is most of these kids fall within the normal intellectual range. Mm-hmm. It might be a little on the lower side, but there are actually kids that have above-average intelligence that had significant prenatal alcohol exposure and may even have a fetal alcohol syndrome diagnosis, per se. And so the struggle can be more with some of the complex cognitive functions, like I mentioned, executive functioning earlier, some of the social mm-hmm. Aspects of it as well. And one of the things that diagnosis does, well, first it tells you what's going on. So it's not attributed to other things like just an oppositional kid, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. You actually understand. And the more supports that can be put in place, kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders can get married. They can have a career. They can contribute to society. But the more support and thoughtful and an effective structure that's put in place early on will help them be even more successful in that. And so those are the things. There's still a lot of questions to be of what exactly does that look like and mean for an educator, for a parent, for a clinician. That's going to be where some of the real fun work ends up happening on how to best optimize their potential.
I do. We had talked about trying to get the word out here. Well, I do want to put a plug in for MOFAS. So I know, Kara, you're a supporter of MOFAST. So MOFAST, for our South Dakota audience, is the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And Minnesota is unique in terms of the state resources that are put into this whole area. So the MOFAST meeting, which will occur in early November this year in Minneapolis, in Brooklyn Park actually, is called FASD Matters. And I'm one of the speakers, and they've asked me to speak on a research update in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So we'll talk about our new criteria as part of that. And Dr. Ken Jones, who was the describer of the first author on the original paper in 1973, will be speaking on a historical spectrum, a historical perspective on this whole area. And then the focus of the meeting is really on stigma, about how stigma for women and stigma for children who've been diagnosed, and how we address that and how we try to minimize that. And so I'm excited. I'm looking forward to the meeting, and they're wonderful folks. You know, we are lucky enough to have Judge Kern, one of our Supreme Court justices here in South Dakota, who's a huge supporter of this movement. Susan Carlson, the wife of Arne Carlson, one of the previous governors of Minnesota, also a family court judge, has been very supportive of this as well. And so we do have some friends in important places who help us get the word out, but MOFAS is one of those organizations, along with the NOFAS, which is the national organization, which has been helpful in educational efforts.
And Amy, do you have plans to follow these kids as they age? Since you, if they've been diagnosed, do you follow them as they're aging and growing and seeing what's happening?
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of resources go into this initial work and then be able to see the long-term effects. So we do have some projects pending to be able to follow the kids long-term. One project in particular to follow them through age 11 to really be able to look at some of that social and learning development throughout. So hopefully more coming soon on that.
I always like to end it with that. No.
Well,
there's a lot more coming. This isn't over, right?
We have fingers and toes crossed on Amy is an absolute magician when it comes to finding funding for our programs in South Dakota and at Sanford Research. And we're hopeful that that will help this group, this large cohort, 12,000 children cohort that she's gathered here in South Dakota.
Okay. And these 12,000, these are just kids that you've interviewed. Not all of them are on the spectrum.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Okay. Just to be clear.
Yep. And that, I think, is one of the things that makes it even more generalizable, is that it is all kids. It represents our region of pediatrics, not just kids that may have been affected.